This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series. This is an incredibly special episode to release. Recorded in multiple locations in Wellington, Aotearoa, Nam, Melbourne, and via Zoom, it is an honour to share these conversations with Kurdish-Iranian writer, journalist, scholar, filmmaker, and refugee advocate Behrouz Bachani, and with his collaborators and translators Omid Tafigian and Munez Mansoubi.
Okay, so Behrouz Bachani, we are here at the after party of Verve Wellington, and I was just getting my drink and ready to try and get the dance floor started, and I said to my friend, is that Behrouz Bachani sitting over there? And they said, yeah, I think it is. And I said, of course it is, because we're in New Zealand, which is where Behrouz now lives. Behrouz Bachani, it's a pleasure to meet you.
That's quite interesting, because when you approached me, I was talking with my friend. You said, probably people here recognize you. And at the first year, people recognize me, but I think most of people forget.
No.
So probably you will publish this later, but I applied for visa from Australia. Hopefully I get it next week.
How does it feel to be applying for a visa to Australia that failed to give you visas when you needed them?
Actually, I feel that I should go there because I've done so much work with the writers and artists in Australia, academics, so I should go because I am going for the book launch of the new book, and also I think it's very important that I raise the voice of people who remain.
As you can hear, I first spoke to Behrouz on the side of a stage at the crowded after party of the Verve Wellington Festival while he was waiting on the outcome of his visa application to Australia so that he could tour his new book, Freedom, Only Freedom.
That is very interesting because I feel the force for when I was applying for visa. And in the form, one of the questions was like this, that have you ever witnessed crime against humanity? And I said no.
Associate Professor Behrouz Bachani graduated from Tarbiyat Mollam University and Tarbiyat Madaris University, both in Tehran. He holds a master's degree in political science, political geography, and geopolitics. He was a writer for the Kurdish language magazine Waria, is associate professor in social sciences at UNSW, non-resident visiting scholar at the Sydney Asia Pacific Migration Centre, University of Sydney, honorary member of PEN International, and winner of an Amnesty International Award 2017, the Diaspora Symposium Social Justice Award, the Liberty Victoria 2018 Empty Chair Award, and the Anna Politkovskaya Award for Journalism. He publishes regularly with The Guardian, and his writing also features in the Saturday Paper, Huffington Post, New Matilda, The Financial Times, and the Sydney Morning Herald. Bachani is also co-director with Arash Kamali Stavastani of the 2017 feature-length film Chokka, Please Tell Us the Time, and collaborator on Nazanin Samihazadeh's play Manas. Bachani's book, No Friend But the Mountains, Writing from Manas Prison, won the 2019 Victorian Prize for Literature in addition to the non-fiction category. He has also won the Special Award at the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, the Australian Book Industry Award for Nonfiction Book of the Year, and the National Biography Prize. The book has been published in 18 languages in 23 countries and is currently being adapted for both stage and screen. I asked Behrouz about his current work.
What does your work involve? So you've just finished writing a book and you're about to start promoting it, but what does your other work involve now?
I'm working on collection of short stories.
Fiction?
Yeah, yeah. And also a movie. So, but I don't believe in writers and artists who talk about their work.
Okay, all right. Well,
they should do it.
Do it. Do the work.
Behrouz Bouchani was a political prisoner incarcerated by the Australian government in Papua New Guinea for almost 7 years. In November 2019, Behrouz escaped to New Zealand. He now resides in Wellington. I asked him what we should be paying attention to in the world right now, and he spoke about the situation in Iran and had a message for writers' festivals everywhere.
This day, I'm just talking about Iran.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important that this revolution that is going on, and the slogan is Woman, Life, Freedom, and in Kurdish is Janjian Azadi. And but that is only something that people see from outside. But this revolution has different layers. And actually, the main movement that is actually participating actually at this revolution is the ethnic minorities movement. Kurdish people especially. And I think that is important that people, I mean, the international community actually try to understand the different layers of this revolution. You know, of course, it is a feminism movement, and it should be like that, and is leading by women, but has different layers as well. So the main layer is people who have been marginalized in Iran for 100 years. I think they are actually leading this revolution. So that is very important that the international community and media, they should give platform to women who are from ethnic minorities, like Kurdish women. But we see only the platform, it just goes to middle class Tehranian women. So that is wrong. So that's what they say. For example, with this festival, you know, I think definitely, I know that they already organized this, but I mean, in the festival, for example, like literature festival, they should have some programs. They should invite Kurdish women, they should invite Iranian women to come and talk about it, to analyze it. And we learn from them that what is going on. You know, this kind of thing that I think the festival should do, and that is very important. Because that revolution doesn't only affect on Iran. That doesn't only affect on Middle East. That affects on the world.
When I met Behrouz in Wellington and we talked about the possibility of me interviewing him in Melbourne around the release of Freedom Only Freedom, he insisted, despite my misgivings at having no preparation, that I record an initial interview on my phone. I did not know whether we would have the opportunity to speak again.
Behrouz Bouchani, I'm still not quite, I'm just telling myself in my head, Kate, you are sitting here at the after party and you're interviewing Behrouz Bouchani because he just asked you to. And I so look forward to speaking to you when I've been able to read your new book, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Have a really good party.
Thank you.
Thanks to Bloomsbury Australia, I did get another opportunity to speak to Behrouz in person in Melbourne ahead of his incredible event at the Wheeler Centre. I hope you are as moved, enraged, and inspired by this conversation as I was. Behrouz Bouchani, it's a delight to be seeing you again in the foreword to your award-winning book, No Friend But the Mountain, Writings from Manus Prison. The Australian writer Richard Flanagan says he looks forward to the day he can welcome you to Australia as a writer. And here you are today. You're going to be speaking with Richard this evening to a sold-out crowd in Melbourne, along with your longtime translators and collaborators, Omid Tofigian and Munez Munsabi. It's such a pleasure and an honour to welcome you to the First Time podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
We have much to talk about, but I hope that you'll allow me to start at the beginning, where we start with all of our writers on the podcast, and ask, at what point did you realise that you were a writer or a storyteller? At what point in your life?
Yeah, I think it takes time that you declare that, and I think that is very important, that moment that you, that time that you accept yourself as a writer, even if you publish nothing, you know. So for me, was like a process of becoming. So I was not, I didn't want to be a writer, you know, so that was a process of becoming. And I think I declared that long time ago. I don't know when was, but definitely it was in Iran, when I was in Iran.
Why did you not want to become a writer?
Because I didn't want, yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about it. I think I was, so my lifestyle was different. So my background and my family. So that's why I didn't grow up in an intellectual family and environment. So that's why that was not my dream. Mm. Yeah.
I know that you started publishing as a journalist while you were in Iran. Can you remember the first time you ever saw your words in print?
I don't remember that time, but always when you publish something, you enjoy that. Mm-hmm. So I think it doesn't matter that how many books that you publish, how many articles that you publish. Any time that you publish something, you feel good about it. And I think that is quite magical.
Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about the writing and the work that you did for the Kurdish language magazine, Weria, the purpose of it and what work that involved?
Yeah, so I come from a part of Kurdistan in west of Iran that has damaged, assimilated. So that is very difficult in that part of Kurdistan. Our people haven't been into Kurdistan resistance history. Mm-hmm. Of course, there were people who participated in that resistance, but that particular part of Kurdistan, people are not really familiar with political culture in Kurdistan. So it's quite unusual that someone like me and some others raised in that part of Kurdistan and try to develop the culture, protect the language, and teach the society that how is important that we keep Kurdish language alive, Kurdish culture alive. So that particular part of Kurdistan is like that. So our people have been losing the language, especially over the past two decades. So I and some of friends, we took that risk to do something for that. And of course, many people have been doing that, but just recently. So we published a magazine just to teach people how it's important to keep the Kurdish language alive in that part of Kurdistan.
How hard was it to distribute and get that magazine out to the readers that you wanted to get it out to?
Yeah, of course, we didn't have money. We didn't have a sponsor. So we just, you know, It was very difficult to publish it, and also it was very difficult to find the readers. Mm. The readers who are interested at that, because people are not familiar with what we were going to teach them or tell them. So it was very difficult. So that's why we just published some, we printed some copies, and we targeted a particular reader. Mm. Yeah. And even we asked them to pass it to another person.
By hand.
Yeah. Because we spent so much time and it's very risky to publish that.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Behrouz, I've been reading back over your your first book, No Friend But the Mountain, and in it you write about travelling to Australia and through Indonesia with a book of poetry. Can you tell us about the importance of poetry in your life and why that was a book you chose to travel with?
Yeah, I think poetry is a part of Kurdish culture and also Persian culture. So in Iran, in Middle East, generally poetry is very important language, and we actually live with poetry. So it's something that we it's just a part of our lives. And so when I came to Australia, I remember, so my friend Sabir Haka, he is a poet. He had his book just recently came out, released, and he was a part of an exhibition, book exhibition, and he gave that book to me and he signed it. Then we went to airport together. So I just took that book, and that book was with me, and even on the boat, and when the boat drowned, still, you know, I could save that book. But in the end, in Manus Island on February 2014, the local attacked our prison camp, and we left the prison camp for like 3-4 hours, and when we came back, they took all of our properties. Mm. So I lost that book there. Mm. So it was a long history with that book, but that was very interesting, that when I arrived in Australia, I had nothing. Even I didn't have shoes, but I just had a book of poetry. Mm.
Let's move to your time on Manus Prison, where you were for 6 years incarcerated by our government. In an article about your work, Guardian journalist Ben Doherty quotes you as saying, "I'm a journalist, and I'm still a journalist in this place. This is my work and my duty." And I want to ask about that experience of doing your investigative journalism while you were also incarcerated. It's an incredible tension that you hold in your work, and a paradox.
It's very difficult. So when I look at that time, that period, so I was a refugee. So when you are a refugee, there is an image about refugees. So that was very difficult to reach to media. It was very difficult that media trust in you, I mean, trust in your skill, because you are, they see you less, you know? So it took really years that I proved that I am, but in the end, I feel that I punished those media, because I feel that the media were among the few people who didn't treat me well. Mm. Yeah. Always I worked with them, I did an interview with them, I collected information for them, I share, you know, ideas with them, but they didn't mention my name as a journalist, you know, because that was against the image they had about refugees. So it was very difficult to create a way, you know. It was very difficult to change, you know, change something, at least about myself. So, but I think just day by day, year by year, yeah, I just, you know, I challenge them always, yeah.
You write about the fact that there's a power structure in the language of journalism as well, which you write back against, or you try and resist, and you specifically write about it too with the idea of photographers and the way that they're capturing these specific kind of, I suppose, trying to make them generic images of refugees, and that you're trying to capture the personal. Can you talk a bit about that, how you are shifting language to move away from the journalistic in what you're writing?
Yeah, of course. I didn't know, you know, media in the West. I didn't know the media well. And I just arrived, you know, and they just put me in that prison camp. So, and also it took time for me to create a network because I didn't know anyone in Australia. So that took at least 2 years that I published my articles under my real name. Before that, I couldn't because I didn't feel safe with the authorities. And after 2 years, when I became sure that I have my own network, so it is difficult for the government or the authorities to do something on me, then I started to publish my work. And but at first, I thought that if I publish just some articles, so people in Australia, they support us or they understand us. They understand how the situation is. But after a while, I realized, no, that doesn't work. Just writing articles and just people read them and then forget about them. So that's why I had to do something else, you know. And I started to, do like use a literary language and also film. Cinema was very important. And I made a movie on my phone called Choke Up Please Tell Us the Time. And that was a very, very difficult process. I did it with my friend and colleague, Arash Kamali Sarvastani. He is based in Netherlands. So it was very, very difficult to, with that very slow internet, and I was not allowed to have phone. So we did it finally. And now that I look at past, I think those journalism works are important because I didn't follow the the language that other media and journalists use. You know, I just try to include the language and the perspective to be politic, you know, even when I was writing about politics. So in this book, I think people can read, even when they read the political opinion piece by me, they see, they feel that politic way or politic elements.
And in doing that, you force us to see Manus Prison and the experiences of the people that were there. In terms of how you were producing and seeing things in your mind and what you wanted to say, how did that process work? Were you just putting down what you saw and getting it out as quickly as you could when you had your phone with you and you weren't being surveilled?
Yeah, I think again, I look at that in a poetic way, that these words, sentences, pages were flying from that tiny island to Australia and get together, and then in the end became a book, you know, and just on the bookshops and everywhere people could see it. So I look at it in that way. But for me, of course, I didn't have this chance or to read my work a lot, to edit them. Of course, I edited them, but we wanted to publish that book as soon as possible. So it was very important that we publish it just to expose that system. So making people aware is not enough, you know, just that people should understand it, you know, and that is if people or some people understand it, that means that you affect, you know. But by making people aware, that doesn't work, I think.
I think I was reading again the section where you are on the boat from Indonesia before you're picked up by the Navy eventually yesterday in your first book, No Friend But the Mountain. And on my way in here, my taxi driver was a man from Afghanistan who had also come by boat. And he was telling me about his journey here. And it felt so very real and present because I'd just been in your words as all those things happened. So I think that is what you're saying, the difference between the awareness and the effect.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Australia is a difficult country as well. It's a, like a paradoxical country, has a paradoxical political culture. So it's very difficult to create change in this country, you know. It's, I don't say it's impossible, but all of us, if we affect this country in some ways, I think in the end we can see some change. And I see some change, but it's not a fundamental change yet.
It's not fast enough. Behrouz, I want to ask you a little bit about responsibility and leadership because in the section particularly, the siege of Manus Prison, which happened in 2017, you're writing diaries during that time and these are in the new book, Freedom Only Freedom. But there's a very real sense of how much pressure is on you as a leader and as a journalist to be everywhere, to witness everything, and to kind of testify about this as well to the outside world. How did you kind of hold that pressure and responsibility?
Yeah, I think that is a very good question. So people who look at these works that written in Manus Island, they think that I just was just sitting down and write. But in the same time, I was, I had to work as a leader as well. Of course, I was not the, we didn't have a main leader. So we were just a group of men who were working together. But of course, I was leading as well, especially in the political, you know, fight in the media with the government. Always we were fighting with the government, so that is really difficult, you know. And in the same time, I had to you know, endure that prison camp as a prisoner. So the difficulty of the prison itself was you know, another challenge. So but for me, what the thing, what was important is to protect my mind, protect my brain, and protect my heart. So I needed some kind of tenderness, and I could get that through, you know, nature, relying on nature, or experience love. Yeah, I think experience love in that context is very important. So I don't know, but I manage it.
You did. One of the key theories that you outline in these works, along with the idea of the Manus Prison theories, is the idea of a hierarchical system. And this is work that's being taken up by researchers and academics around the world. Can you explain the hierarchical system and how it applies to Manus Prison and the policies of Australian governments?
Yeah, hierarchical system is the concept that Omid used in the book. I used another word, but of course in Farsi, I used the word system hakam. It means that a system of hakam, if I translate, is like governing. Yeah. So Omid suggested that he translate that word because he said that there is not an English word for that. It's difficult. So he used that term, hierarchical system. But of course, the meaning is same, you know. And the hierarchical system, I think, is a system of control, you know, a mentality that design a system to control people, you know. And I think this concept helped us to see Manus Prison system beyond Manus Prison. I mean, we see it, we expand it to out of prison camp, you know. So that's why we say that there are many twins, you know, for Manus Prison. But Manus Prison is a very original version of that system. So it's very important that we understand it. It is a system of a very bureaucratic system, you know. So we have that, you know, out of that prison camp, you know, here. You know, always we are dealing with a kind of bureaucratic system, even when we go to a restaurant. You know, that recently we should just go and order, or airports, I don't know, universities, many places. So, you know, in the airport, in the university, I feel manus a lot.
The examples, one of the examples that you give in Freedom Only Freedom is to outline in detail the horrendous bureaucracy of trying to get medical care in Manus prison. Can you just say a little about that?
Yeah, if I say it in a very simple words, so when you become sick in that prison camp, you should follow the a process, which is fill a form, put it in the box, and wait for, I don't know, a week. Then you receive a letter that you have an appointment. So you go there, so they search your body in the gate. Then you go to another gate, they search your body again, then another gate, they search your body, then yet they put you in a car with like four or five officers. They took you to somewhere, then they search your body again. Then you go in the medical system, they search your body again. Then you see the doctor, and doctor doesn't provide medical treatment. So you don't get that, you know? And then you should do this process again to come back to the prison camp. So this process, so if you do it once, it's okay. But if you do it a lot, that what the detainees do, you know, and they get painkillers, all of, you know, they get addicted to that system. So it's a process like this, you know. So that is horrible, you know. It's very bureaucratic, and it's, I think the violence is there. The real, the true violence come from that system, you know. And but in the end, you don't get medical treatment. So even when you see a doctor, they put you in a list to wait. So it's very, very complicated.
And the violence came in many ways. Not only did the absence of medical care lead to the deaths of detainees, but also a word that you use repeatedly is the idea of humiliation, and the idea of humiliation as a violence, which is inherent in that kind of a system.
Definitely. So violence has different, you know, is not only physical. So physical violence is nothing actually compared to like humiliation. You know, humiliation targets your dignity. And that system design to take that dignity from you. And, you know, or the whole system designed to dehumanize people, you know. And so that is violent, you know. That is a deep violence that you cannot, that damage you in a way that you always, in rest of your life, or at least for many years, you should carry that, you know. So, yeah, that is a, I think that's why I say in the book, I say the most violent people in that system were doctors, not the officers.
You also talk about the idea of the time tunnel. And I know, you know, we get told this indefinite detention is kind of a phrase that is just has lost all meaning for us. But that idea of the time tunnel and time not being something that you had any control over, about knowing when you came out, that also is a type of violence.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, so that system design that you wait, so you don't know how long you stay there, how many years, they never give you an answer. And I think that comes from the way the system see refugees. Mm. They see refugees as a people who are useless. Mm. They are not important. They are less. Mm. Or they are not... because that's why their time is not important. Mm. So we can keep them there for 10 years, for 7 years. But that is their time. They are not valued. Their time is not valuable. Mm. That's how the system see. And that is racism as well, you know. That when you put some people in a prison camp and you see that they are not important, their time is not important. Mm. They are human beings, so of course they can do many things. So that come from that mentality, you know. But of course, time in that context is a tool of torture. You know, they use that to torture people, to destroy people. And when you even come out, you should deal with those years that you lost. Mm. And that is, I think, the very, very deep violence. Mm. And I'm sure that many people cannot cope with that in the rest of their lives because they always should think about the past and those years that they lost. Mm.
You tell your story in these books, but you've also said it's not just your personal story. And one of the features of your work is your ability to put stories and the hopes and dreams and sufferings of other people who you were with into your work. I know that this was also difficult because, of course, you had to protect the identities of some people as well. Why is it so important to you to share these stories of people's background?
Yeah, because, you know, the system, they send people, they banish people to a place to be out of sight and out of mind. So it's very important that you make that visible through your writing, you know, that people connect with them, with the people, and bring their humanity back, you know, in your writing or your work. Because otherwise just there are some numbers for people, you know, from outside. There are just some numbers. But when you see their different layers of their personalities, characters, and doesn't, I don't mean that they are, we picture them or describe them as an angel. You know, they are not. They are just people like others. So, but that connection, I think, is important, you know, and sometimes that connection happens through humor. When you feel these people are funny sometimes, when you see that people are, you know, feel their sadness, how they, I think that is very important just to, because they just banish people to a place to be out of sight, you know, that is important, you know, just to, that people feel, you know, people feel the refugees, feel people there. Mm. So, but of course it was difficult because, you know, I have an article about LGBTQ people.
Yes.
In Manus. And for many years I wanted to write about them. Then I talked with Janet Galbraith, and she told me that, I said, I cannot, because they hide themselves, I cannot find them. But I know that they are living in this prison camp. And she said, so just write about this that you cannot write about them. So that became an article, you know. It's very difficult to write about individuals because you should get permission from them. And also, even when you write it with literary language, of course, you don't have to get permission if you write it in a different way. So I had to mix some characters to create a new character, you know, so just to protect them. And so it's very difficult, you know, but that's good. That was good as well, because that gave me the space that I get to be more creative. Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about your different collaborations, and first I want to touch on this idea that you said until you had a network, you didn't feel safe to publish under your name. Can you tell me a bit about that first network, about Janet Galbraith, and that first network that you built so that you could feel safe in publishing?
Yeah. So I didn't know anyone, as I said before. So I met Janet through internet. And that time was just I smuggled phone in. So, but finding Janet was difficult as well. Because I think Janet contacted me. So a refugee there went back to Iran and he told Janet that, yes, Behrouz is there, he is a writer. And then she found me. So I forget the details, but through Janet then I met Shane Basie. I met, he was doing advocacy. And then through him, I don't remember, but Ben Doherty was one of the first people that I contacted. And then after that, Munes Mansoubi, she started to translate my works, even when we didn't publish them. Just she translated them for that we used them for reporting for journalism, but without my name and her name. So yeah, Munes started, and then after that though, just my network getting bigger and more people became aware of me, that so it took years. And later I just met Omid as well, that he read one of my articles and he contacted me, so then we worked together. Just some other, just network became bigger and bigger.
In terms of the translation, because you sent messages to Munez in Farsi and she translated, and Omid has written about this, and so have you in the works, about the nature of language and of translation and about some of the very long conversations that they have had together as your collaborators and with you about getting the language right. What is it like to be in that continual process of translation, writing in Farsi, seeing it written back to you in English? Is there lots that is lost?
I think in the process of translation, because we used to read in, translation works, you know, but you are English, you don't have to.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to read, translate some words, but mostly language, English is a big language, is a very, so we as a, you know, Kurdish, for Persian, and even German, French, you know, so I think the rest of the world, they used to read work through translation. And so we are, we know that, but for me, I think in the process of translation, something get lost, but I think something new you see that you cannot feel it or see it in your work. So that is the process of translation. But that is my understanding of it. But I think Omid has done a great job. He spent so much time. I think he was focused on the work, and it was very important for him as well, personally and professionally, to do his work very well. And Munes as well, I think Munes did a great job as well. So in the end, we create all of these materials.
At Behrouz's request, it gives me great pleasure to welcome translators and collaborators Omid Tafigian and Munes Mansoubi to the podcast. Omid Tafigian is an award-winning lecturer, researcher, and community advocate. His publications include the translation of Buchani's award-winning No Friend But the Mountains, Writings from Manus Prison.
Munez Mansoubi is a translator and community arts and cultural development worker based in Sydney. Her work is dedicated mainly to supporting and collaborating with migrants and people seeking asylum in Australia. Thank you both so much for joining me during what I know is a very busy time for you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Kate.
Munez, if I can start with you, in one of the chapters of Freedom Only Freedom, you describe how you first began working with refugees on Manus and Nauru through a Twitter post. Can you tell us a little bit about this and how you first came to work with Beirut?
Yeah, sure. So I just started working with refugees in Sydney and through different type of works. And then, so I was working in that area, and one day, and I was just following the advocates on Twitter. And one day, and because I just recently migrated to Australia, so maybe my network was not that big. And one day I saw Shane Bazzi, one of the advocates. He posted something that he's looking for someone who can translate from Persian to English. And then I replied to that, and it was the beginning of our work with Behrouz. So first I was just working with Shane. Shane was in between sending me different things, but then I started working with Behrouz directly. But still I was collaborating with Shane as well to support some other refugees on Manus and Nauru.
Munez, we've just been talking before we started recording about how busy your life is and all of the type of work that you do. How did you fit this kind of work in to the work that you were doing, and what kind of time was it taking for you as well?
Yeah, so I think the main reason that I can just work out is my passion, because I'm really passionate about everything that I'm doing. So back to Behrouz, so Omid also can talk about it. So when I was working with Behrouz, mainly when he was writing his articles, majority of them were very urgent, so we had to get it translated urgently, because it was news and important news, so we couldn't waste time. So I remember that I was just staying up at night, and he was, because mainly he also works at nights, so, and he was just sending the text messages, the articles that he was writing, and I was translating them simultaneously. So that was the way that we were working together.
Thank you. Omid, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to start working with both Munez and Behrouz?
Definitely. Like Munez, I've been working in this space for a long time, not in a different way to Munez. So Munez has been working in particular organizations and of course, working with advocates. But I think her work is a lot more structured, and she has a lot bigger network, so especially in the community space. So even though I'm a community advocate, I've been more of an activist, a scholar activist, I'd say. So I think I started working with people in detention just before the Pacific Solution began in 2001. And then I went overseas for some time. And then when I came back, I came with a whole new vision, a new way of trying to do things. So I worked in the community space, but not in a structured way like Munez. It was more with individuals or smaller groups. And I think at a certain time after I came back from overseas, a couple of years later, the second phase of the Pacific Solution started, and I started to get involved in activism again since I came back to Australia. And it was right at the beginning of 2016 that I read Munez's translation of Behrouz's work in The Guardian. And it was the first time that Behrouz had published using his real name. And the article had a massive impact on me. And also I was surprised that I didn't know about this since I've been working in this space for quite some time. And I thought, who is this person? And I'd love to support them if I can. And I think I could feel how urgent it was. So Munis talked about the urgency. Mm-hmm. I could feel that coming through the article. So I sent Behrouz a Facebook post. And luckily, with his smuggled phone and with the terrible internet, he was suspicious of people getting in touch with him just randomly. And he opened my message and we started a conversation. And soon after, we moved to WhatsApp. And the rest is history. We started working together from there.
It's quite an incredible history, and I know that some of our listeners will know about it, but I'd love to ask you both a little bit more about this incredibly arduous process. You've said about the urgency, the smuggled phone, the working at night, the terrible internet. Behrouz has described it as helping his words fly from the little island to Australia to get them out. Can you just give us a sense from your perspective how you both began working together and with Behrouz on what would become Freedom Only Freedom?
Actually, for me, it's been a learning journey, really. I have been learning a lot from Omid and Behrouz, both of them. And I really like the intellectual side of that, because we started having a very depth conversation about policies, how the Australian detention system works and all of those that, and it really worked out, I think. We were learning from each other. At the same time, we were supporting each other, you know.
Yeah, no, that was really an important point about the intellectual discussions. And I think one of the things that connected me with Munis and with Behrouz and really created a special kind of magic, I think, was the fact that we have we're passionate, but we're also very philosophical, and we also appreciate the academic side or the intellectual side of this kind of work. And we also have a love for literature and the arts. So all of these things came into play. All of them really facilitated our relationship. And you can see that in the translations. You can see it's hard to really explain. It probably needs a lot more analysis and a special kind of article to explain it. But there are so many layers there. So when Munis translates, she translates in a way that brings out the references to a literary history, to a cultural history, to a political history in Behrouz's works. And I do the same as well. And, you know, I bring also my philosophical training and expertise in there too. And so much of what goes into the articles also comes out of our discussions. So sometimes the discussions influence the way Behrouz writes, and sometimes the discussions influence the way we translate. And there's this really interesting back and forth. So, yeah, it's almost like a whole ecosystem of its own.
It's brought my attention to the fact that translation is so much more than just the act of shifting language, you know, from one language to another. Can you give an example of perhaps one of those conversations or one of the things that you had to think deeply about in making sure that the meaning, the references, Behrouz's intent all came across, and the way that you worked in that ecosystem, perhaps?
I guess the first thing that comes to mind, maybe one of the most important things, is how we translated a really key term, the kyriarchal system.
Yes.
So and this involved a lot of discussion, a lot of back and forth, a lot of change as well, a lot of adjustment. So the term that Behrouz uses in Farsi is sistema hakem. And hakem can be translated, like many of the words that we have to deal with, hakem can be translated into maybe almost a dozen words. And you need to find the right word that matches what he's talking about and all the different connections that it has with other parts of the book and, you know, his experience as well. So hakem, you know, could be translated as something like sovereign, controlling, dominating, oppressing, controlling, so many different terms. But the word, and I actually started translating sistema hakem as oppressive system, in the beginning. And I think it was through, of course, through conversations with Muniz, and I would always explain to Muniz, I'm not happy with this translation. System of Hakim is, it can be oppressive system, but it's so much more than that. It goes way beyond it. And so I kept it as oppressive system. And then I think about 2 months into the translation process, and constantly thinking about it and staying up at night and, not being able to switch off. And I was constantly thinking about it. And then I remembered some research that I'd done years and years ago in the area of feminist philosophy and also critical religious studies. And there's a radical feminist theologian named Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza who coined the term kyriarchy. And it's very complicated, but it's in general, it means interlocking systems of oppression that are obsessed with control and domination and also subjugation, submission. So without going into too much detail, I thought this was the perfect term to apply in this context. So system of Hakem in this case became the kyriarchal system. So a new term that Behrouz uses in Farsi, I can't find any other references to it. So a new term in Farsi becomes a new term in English, which I thought was really special. And it worked. It was a huge risk because, it could be lost amongst a lot of people. It could be interpreted as being, way too complicated and a bit too distant from, for a lot of readers. But it worked. It's been talked about quite a bit now.
I'm so glad you used that example because I asked Behrouz about it and he gave his perspective on that translation as well. And for listeners, the explanation in Freedom Only Freedom is wonderful as well. One of the things that Behrouz said is so important in his work is that he wants the writing to have a tangible effect on the reader rather than just making the reader aware of what for instance, was happening on Manus Prison. And I wanted to ask about how you held that in your mind as you worked on the translation.
So I think for us was the same because so for us, like translating and working on translating Behrouz's work and working with him was not only about like spreading his word, but it has like the layers of advocacy that we really wanted to achieve. And I think we were both angry about what was happening and we couldn't really sit and do nothing. That's why I think for us was the same. We wanted to bring like transformative change to this system and make the like not only making like the public aware of what's happening there, but do something. And this was the main thing for me, and I'm sure it was the main thing for Omid as well, because we were anyway working in this area for quite a time.
Muniz explained it really well, but I will say that to have that effect, to make that impact that goes beyond just raising awareness, it also involved knowing the author in special ways. So, and it impacted and it influenced the way we chose words as well. So, like I mentioned before, one word in Persian or Farsi could be translated in sometimes half a dozen or, 10 ways. And to find that perfect word that really lifts or adds that extra layer and really lifts it into a new space, where that new emotional space, that was something that really brought in our interactions with Behrouz, our friendship with Behrouz, but also our passion and our commitment as well. A commitment to changing things.
Muniz, you and Omid both spoke so passionately and urgently about the current situation in Iran at the Wheeler Center event that I attended with Behrouz this past week. I wonder if you could give us your perspective on what is currently happening in Iran. I know we have such a small amount of time and you can't possibly sum it up, but just for our listeners to be paying attention to that.
Sure. Maybe I start with the most human slogan of this movement, which is Zhenjian Azadi, Zan Zendegi Azadi, Woman Life Freedom. So the first one is in Kurdish because this slogan comes from Kurdistan. And there is a philosophy behind it, which is which includes struggle, resistance, and existence of women and all suppressed human beings. So it is about women's rights. It is a feminist movement, and the leaders of this are women. But at the same time, it is about all the suppressed human beings, like minorities in Iran, ethnic communities in Iran, like people who have like who are a minority when it comes to religion or whatever other form of way of thinking that they have been suppressed by this regime. And I'm sure that your listeners know about how it started. So it started by the death of Mahsa Jina Amini, who was a 22 years old Kurdish girl. She came to Tehran only for a holiday, and in a way that they just describe it, she didn't wear appropriate hijab, and she was arrested by the so-called morality police. It's been very tough for us, really, for all of Iranians inside the country and outside the country in diaspora. And as Omid said, that we really acknowledge and appreciate the bravery of people in Iran because they put their life in risk for fighting against this regime. And they have been so cruel. Every day we just hear like the news of murder, imprisonment, torture, and second execution just happened on Monday. So, and it's going on and going on, and we don't really know what would be the end. Omid, would you like to add anything to this?
Yeah, actually, thank you for that, Munis. I think one thing that is also important and relates to our collaboration, our connection with Behruz, is that we can see so much of this system of Hakem, or the kariakal system, in the way that Iran is structured, the way that society is ordered, and the way that people are oppressed. So we could already see Behruz's critique of the prison system, the border violence, or the border industrial complex, I sometimes call it. We could see so much of what was happening there already in the place that Behruz fled. And I think the other thing that really combined us very well was the fact that, so Munis obviously is a woman and lived majority of her life in Iran and in that oppressive system, which discriminates against women. It's an apartheid system when it comes to women. And, you know, for Munis, I'm sure Munis will be able to explain better, but I'm sure she could see so much of what Behruz was going through in relation to her own experience as a woman in Iran. I left Iran around the time of the revolution, the 79 revolution, and experienced displacement and exile in different ways. And so my family are from a persecuted group, but not like Behruz, based on ethnicity, but based on socio-religious status. And so when I started working with Behruz, so much of what he was saying about Kurdish resistance and the oppression of Kurds in Iran, I could identify with. I could, you know, it was so much of it was really immediate really connected with me. And on top of that, you know, Munis and I also know very well what it's like to experience racism in Australia. So, you know, on so many different levels, being marginalized, persecuted, being on the outskirts, being on the fringe, being outcast in so many different ways, being oppressed in different ways. You know, all of these things came together that made it really beautiful. But at the same time, what's happening now makes it hard for us to really enjoy what's happening with the book and with Behrouz's visit to Australia. It's just such a mix of different feelings. Of course, there's a lot of pride, a lot of celebration, a lot of joy, as I mentioned, a lot of hope. But at the same time, it's extremely traumatizing and distressing. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, sorry, and we really expect like Australian government to take an effective action. You know, people, Iranians, and like our supporters are protesting here in all over Australia every weekend to just amplify the voice of people in Iran. And I'm not sure why the Australian government has not been supportive in the way that we expect them and demand them.
Although I will mention the one very, very promising move that was made just the other day is that Australia did support the removal of Iran from the UN Committee for the Status of Women.
Yes.
So that's one sign, move in the right direction. But so much more needs to happen. And
Should close like their embassy here, you know, and they should like freeze all the asset of Iranian government people.
You both shared some information about organizations where Australians and potentially our listeners could go to learn more and to support and to ask for action from the Australian government. I'm going to put those links in the show notes, but perhaps you could just explain those organizations to us a little more.
Yes, thank you for that, Kate. Just very briefly, United Action for Iran is a collective of different Iranian community organizations in Australia. And the other one is the National Assembly of Iranian Jurists, and that's an international organization. And please go to the website, look for them online, look at the flyer that you've put up in relation to this podcast. And, you know, there are a lot of things there to sign. There are links and different functions on the page where you can sign things and you can share with friends and family and people who are interested. We need collective action for things to work, for things to change. People need to come together. And it's also a great sign of solidarity and humanity from the Australian people for the Iranian people, which energizes them and gives them hope to keep going.
You've talked about the fact that it's joy, but also this terrible traumatizing time in Iran at the moment. What has it been like to see Behrouz welcomed by so many people in Australia?
For me, it was a sense of pride. Behrouz really worked tirelessly when he was on Manus, and he really deserved a magnificent welcome from Australian community. And, you know, he actually brought like a very important topic to the discourse, which is a part of Australian history anyway, and we can't deny that. So for me, I was really happy. Yeah, so considering those things that we discussed before, but yeah. I am very happy, and I can't see this as a victory, but I can see that as an achievement.
Yeah, I agree with Munis. Definitely it's an achievement, but very far from a victory, because I think at the same time as feeling a sense of pride and also a sense of empowerment, that Behrouz he's able to come here. We have to face the fact that there are still so many people in detention and so many people living in limbo, tens of thousands of people who have no clear future. But I will say this is one thing that inspires us and motivates us. I think Munis will agree that it's basically Behrouz's writing that one led to him being granted a visit visa for New Zealand to attend a literary festival, and then getting a visa to stay there. And then it was also another book that brought him to Australia. It helped get a visa for him to come to Australia. So literature on its own may not be able to change a lot, but in connection with a whole lot of other forms of activism, you know, different strategies and different techniques can really change things. And I think maybe one thing that a lot, hopefully will come out of this is hopefully a lot of things, but one of the things is that this can be a model. This kind of collaboration between us can be a model to support and empower a lot of other people and lead to sustainable change, systemic change.
There's something interesting about the event in Sydney. So a couple of people with lived experience just joined the discussion, which was amazing. So they were given a microphone to just share their stories. And as Omid mentioned, so it could be a start for more collaborative work in future to bring sustainable change. Yeah. Mm. And it was beautiful, really, when people felt that they can share the story and get engaged in the discussion.
Mm. That really beautifully leads into my final question, which is to ask you both what you feel the legacy of your work with Beirut and Beirut's work has been and will continue to be, both for the global community and for you both personally.
Of course, there are many things that we would like to happen as a result of this kind of work. But one of the things is, and Beirut talks about this a lot in his work and in his speeches, and that's it, to change the image of refugees and rather than see them as weak and needy and always vulnerable, always as victims. This kind of work presents people in those situations as knowledge producers and as creatives, as empowered, as people who have a special kind of agency. You know, this kind of work shows that all people, whether they're involved in advocacy, academia, the arts, on every level, can really benefit from collaboration and from the ideas and the insights of people in these situations.
Yeah, I completely agree to what Omid said. And my ultimate aim is social justice.
Munes Mansoubi and Omid Tafigian, it has been a great pleasure to speak with you both. Thank you both for your continual hard work, your advocacy, and for giving us some time today as part of this very special conversation about Beirut's work.
My great pleasure.
My pleasure.
In many of the pieces you have, you have journalism, you have memoir, you have poetry in there as well. You have these retold stories. What do you describe this material, this literary work as?
I think that is who I am, you know. Yeah, that is who I am. And I think that effect on the language, you know, because I hate politics, but I am a political person.
Yeah.
I hate it, but I'm a political person because of my background as a Kurd, because of the place I born, I grew up, and politics always chase us everywhere. Even if you don't want politics chase you. So politics is there, and also, you know, that sense of poetry is there. You know, natural element is there. You know, relying on nature. Understanding of nature is there, humor is there, and be tough, you know, in the same time. So I think that's who I am, I think.
In talking about artistic creation, not only have you worked in different mediums, so you've also got filmmaking, you've written a play, and then other artists are now also working with your words. So someone's written a symphony based on your work. There's visual art as well. What do you see as important about working in these different mediums? How is it for you, and how is it seeing your work being translated in these ways?
I think that is very important, because why we are writing, you know. So I'm writing, or I was writing, these works just to, you know, affect, to create change. And of course, in that context, these works are important that other artists, academics, so many people can approach that material, and they bring those materials and interpret them into their own work and their own language. If they are visual artists, so of course they have their own language, but that material is an original material is there. So, or even if an academic or playwright or any artist, you know, so the material is there. So my role here is to just guide them or help them to understand these works, you know. So that's why, and of course, in the process of like creation, I have been working with them as well. So there are big materials actually we created. So for people who want to know, if they go and do search about it, they see that there is a really a big body of works created over the past 10 years, 9 years.
Are there moments when you ever feel you can step back from the political and the nature of the work and have a more artistic response to someone who has, like when you first heard the symphony, the Manus symphony, what's the personal kind of response that you have, the artistic response?
I am always an artist, and I am an artist now.
Yes. Eventually you came to Christchurch in Aotearoa from when you were in Port Moresby, and you wrote during your TED talk that you gave 3 years ago. This was before that.
I hate that work.
You hate it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I didn't know what his TED talk is.
Huh.
Otherwise, I wouldn't do it.
That's interesting. Yeah. You wish you could take it back?
No, I don't care, yeah.
What I think was interesting about it is you said that maybe when you're a free man, you would write about love and life and the meaning of life, and you would leave the stories of Manus to other people, to researchers, to academics. And I want to ask if you have found space since you have been in New Zealand to write outside of this work, this incredibly important work that you are doing.
Yeah, of course. I've been writing something very different. So I'm not writing about refugees.
I know you don't like to talk about what you're writing now because you told me this when we met in Wellington.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you about what it is. But I did really like an interview you did with SBS where you talked about the importance of cycling and of walking to your creative process and how that helps your writing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I really like walking, big walk. So that is my, especially walking on the street.
Because you're
observing. The problem is that I like to smoke as well. That is, I hate that. Yeah. So I should have, yeah. So it's not very healthy. It's not fully, it's healthy, but yeah. So that is my favorite thing, to walk on streets. Yeah. But a long walk. I listen to short stories a lot.
What kind of short stories are you listening to? Or what are some of your
fiction,
favorites?
Fiction. But in terms of listening, I find Ernest Hemingway really, I think his works, when you listen to them, is very different. Yeah.
Can you give me any advice for other writers from what you've learned about your own creative process?
I think I say that before. Somewhere, I think, in an interview, or like, I think writing is like being addictive to, like addicted to a drug.
Yes.
So you know that what you should drink or what you should eat to keep you high or calm down, or, you know, so you learn how to live with that drug, you know, you learn how to live with that. So writing is like that as well. And I think for any person is a different style or different way. So some writers are very lazy, some writers are very, have a very, they are very disciplined. They wake up in a particular time, they, you know. But I think for me, I even include walking as a part of the process of writing. Mm. So when I'm walking on the street, I feel that I'm working, you know.
It's good. It's good.
But the problem is that you should make a rule. If you include that as a process of writing, after a while you find out that you just walk, but you don't write. So that is acceptable if you write as well.
When we met in Wellington, I asked you about what was important to pay attention to at the moment, and you were talking about the situation in Iran now. And I wanted to ask, who perhaps are some of the writers and activists that we should be listening to, and the stories we should be listening to learn more about the protests and to understand or add our support?
I think for understanding of the protest and different layers of the protest, and it doesn't matter politics generally, I think the best way is to just go and listen and read works written by minorities. So in Australia, if you come here as a visitor, if you want to know about this country, you should go and sit down with minorities. They give you the best and deep analyze of that this country, politics in this country. So that is my advice. Everywhere that you go, anything that happened in the world and you are interested at that, you just go and read written by minorities. Yeah, so in the Iranian context and this particular protest, I think just listening to minorities, especially Kurdish people, because Kurdistan is leading this protest. Yeah.
Behrouz, in one of your interviews, you talked about the cost of your writing. And I know that also you are prolific and very active on social media in sharing the kinds of stories from minorities that come out of places, including Iran. What has been the cost of being such an activist for you?
I think when you try to challenge the mainstream, of course, you already create an enemy. So dealing with enemies is difficult. It's not easy. Because mainstream always has this power to marginalize you. So that means that you already choose to be marginalized, you know, and that is very difficult. But my personal experience is that mainstream, so I'm talking about in Iranian context, the mainstream, first they want to take control of you, and sometimes give you a platform just to take control of you. But when they cannot, they start to dehumanize you, you know. But the problem is that after a while, these minorities, they get affected by the mainstream, what they say about you. So you become marginalized, double marginalized. Yeah, it's very difficult. Yeah, sometimes I want to just go on. Just forget about it.
You are here talking about your time on Manus. There are still men in Port Moresby who are there, who have not, refugees who have not been resettled. What is the continuing kind of legacy of your work? In terms of being an advocate for other refugees still incarcerated by the Australian government?
Yeah, of course, everywhere that I go and anything I do, I just raise that issue. But for now, I think less than 100 people are in Port Moresby. So recently, some of them transferred to New Zealand. So hopefully next year, by the beginning of next year, some others come to New Zealand as well. And in Nauru as well. So, yeah, just it's very difficult. It's not easy just to deal with a particular issue for many years. But we should fight for them as well.
Beirut, can I ask you to leave our listeners with a recommendation of a book, any book that you think that our listeners should be aware of and should read?
Yeah, writers, when they recommend a book, they recommend their friend's book.
Oh, well, you can definitely do that if you would like.
I think my book, the book that I really like is written by, so for my friend or the person that I know is, I think many people already read that book, but I should say it again. The Yell, written by Tara June Winch.
Yes.
Yeah, I think many people already read it. But for the book that I like is a book written by Italo Calvino. But my problem is that I read it in Farsi, so I don't know the translation of that. Is the very, very famous book is about...
Yeah,
If on a Winter Night, a Traveler.
Yes.
Yeah, so I like this book a lot, yeah.
Excellent. Beirut Bachani, thank you so much for your time today and also for your words. Good luck.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
The rest of your travels, and we hope that as many people read Freedom Only Freedom who have read No Friend But the Mountains, extraordinary books, and thank you for your work.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.